Chapter 25. The combat at Versailles. I afterwards came to be Berry's fag, and, though beaten by him daily, he allowed, of course, no one else to lay a hand upon me, and I got no more thrashing than was good for me. Thus an intimacy grew up between us, and after he left Slaughterhouse, and went into the Dragoons, the honest fellow did not forget his old friend, but actually made his appearance one day in the playground in mustaches and a braided coat, and gave me a gold pencil case and a couple of sovereigns. I blushed when I took them, but take them I did, and I think the thing I almost best recollect in my life is the sight of Berry getting behind an immense bay cab horse, which was held by a correct little groom, and was waiting near the school in Slaughterhouse Square. He proposed to have me to Alms, where he was lodging for the time, but this invitation was refused on my behalf by Dr. Buckle, who said, and possibly with correctness, that I should get little good by spending my holiday with such a scapegrace. Once afterwards he came to see me at Christchurch, and we made a show of writing to one another, and didn't, and always had a hearty mutual goodwill, and though we did not quite burst into tears on parting, were yet quite happy when occasion threw us together, and so almost lost sight of each other. I heard lately that Berry was married, and am rather ashamed to say that I was not so curious as even to ask the maiden name of his lady. Last summer I was at Paris, and had gone over to Versailles to meet a party, one of which was a young lady to whom I was tenderly, but, never mind. The day was rainy, and the party did not keep its appointment, and after yawning through the interminable palace picture galleries, and then making an attempt to smoke a cigar in the palace garden for which crime I was nearly run through the body by a rascally sentinel, I was driven, perforce, into the great bleak lonely place before the palace, with its roads branching off to all the towns in the world, which Louis and Napoleon once intended to conquer, and there enjoyed my favorite pursuit at leisure, and was meditating whether I should go back to Ypres for dinner, or patronize my friend M. Dubox of the Hôtel des Reservoirs, who gives not only a good dinner, but as dear a one as heart can desire. I was, I say, meditating these things, when a carriage passed by. It was a smart low calash, with a pair of bay horses, and a postillion in a drab jacket that twinkled with innumerable buttons, and I was too much occupied in admiring the build of the machine, and the extreme tightness of the fellow's inexpressibles, to look at the personages within the carriage, when the gentleman roared out "Fitz!" And the postillion pulled up, and the lady gave a shrill scream, and a little black-muzzled spaniel began barking and yelling with all his might, and a man with mustaches jumped out of the vehicle, and began shaking me by the hand. "Drive home, John," said the gentleman. "L.L. be with you, my love, in an instant. It's an old friend. Fitz, let me present you to Mrs. Berry." The lady made an exceedingly gentle inclination of her black velvet bonnet, and said, "Pray, my love, remember that it is just dinner time. However, never mind me." And with another slight toss and a nod to the postillion, that individual's white leather breeches began to jump up and down again in the saddle, and the carriage disappeared, leaving me shaking my old friend Berry by the hand. He had long quitted the army, but still wore his military beard, which gave to his fair pink face a fierce and lion-like look. He was extraordinarily glad to see me, as only men are glad who live in a small town or in dull company. There is no destroyer of friendships like London, where a man has no time to think of his neighbor, and has far too many friends to care for them. He told me in a breath of his marriage, and how happy he was, and straight insisted that I must come home to dinner and see more of Angelica, who had invited me herself. Didn't I hear her? Mrs. Berry asked you, Frank, but I certainly did not hear her ask me. She would not have mentioned the dinner, but that she meant me to ask you. I know she did, cried Frank Berry. Andy, besides, hang it, I'm master of the house. So come you shall. No ceremony, old boy, one or two friends, snug family party, and we'll talk of old times over a bottle of claret. There did not seem to me to be the slightest objection to this arrangement, except that my boots were muddy, and my coat of the morning sort. But as it was quite impossible to go to Paris and back again in a quarter of an hour, and as a man may dine with perfect comfort to himself in a frock coat, it did not occur to me to be particularly squeamish, or to decline an old friend's invitation upon a pretext so trivial. Accordingly, we walked to a small house in the Avenue de Paris, and were admitted first into a small garden ornamented by a grotto, a fountain, and several nymphs in plaster of Paris, then up a moldy old steep stair into a hall, where a statue of Cupid and another of Venus welcomed us with their eternal simper, then through a salle manger, where covers were laid for six, and finally to a little saloon, where Fido the dog began to howl furiously according to his wont. It was one of the old pavilions that had been built for a pleasure house in the gay days of Versailles, ornamented with abundance of damp cupids and cracked gilt cornices, and old mirrors let into the walls, and gilded once, but now painted a dingy French white. The long low windows looked into the court, where the fountain played its ceaseless dribble, surrounded by numerous rank creepers and weedy flowers, but in the midst of which the statues stood with their bases quite moist and green. I hate fountains and statues in dark confined places. That cheerless endless plashing of water is the most inhospitable sound ever heard. The stiff grin of those French statues, or ogling Canova graces, is by no means more happy, I think, than the smile of a skeleton, and not so natural. Those little pavilions in which the old row is sported were never meant to be seen by daylight, depend on it. They were lighted up with 100 wax candles, and the little fountain yonder was meant only to cool their claret. And so, my first impression of Barry's place of abode was rather a dismal one. However, I heard him in the salle manger drawing the corks, which went off with a cloop, and that consoled me. As for the furniture of the rooms appertaining to the Barrys, there was a harp in a leather case, and a piano, and a flute box, and a huge tambour with a Saracen's nose just begun, and likewise on the table a multiplicity of those little gilt books, half sentimental and half religious, which the wants of the age, and of our young ladies have produced in such numbers of late. I quarrel with no lady's taste in that way, but ego. I had rather that Mrs. Fitzpoodle should read Humphrey Clinker. Besides these works, there was a earage, of course. What genteel family was ever without one? I was making for the door, to see Frank drawing the corks, and was bounced at by the amiable little black-muzzled spaniel, who fastened his teeth in my pantaloons, and received a polite kick in consequence, which sent him howling to the other end of the room, and the animal was just in the act of performing that feat of agility, when the door opened and Madame made her appearance. Frank came behind her, peering over her shoulder with rather an anxious look. Mrs. Barry is an exceedingly white and lean person. She has thick eyebrows, which meet rather dangerously over her nose, which is Grecian, and a small mouth with no lips, a sort of feeble pucker in the face as it were. Under her eyebrows are a pair of enormous eyes, which she is in the habit of turning constantly sealing warts. Her hair is rather scarce, and worn in bandeau, and she commonly mounts a sprig of laurel, or a dark flower or two, which with the sham tour I believe that is the name of the knob of artificial hair, that many ladies sport gives her a rigid and classical look. She is dressed in black, and has invariably the neatest of silk stockings and shoes. For forsooth her foot is a fine one, and she always sits with it before her, looking at it, stamping it, and admiring it a great deal. "Ido," she says to her spaniel, "you have almost crushed my poor foot." Or, "Frank," to her husband, "bring me a footstool." Or, "I suffer so from cold in the feet," and so forth. But be the conversation what it will, she is always sure to put her foot into it. She invariably wears on her neck the miniature of her late father, Sir George Coddicombe, apothecary to George III. semicolon, and she thinks those two men the greatest the world ever saw. She was born in Baker Street, Portman Square, and that is saying almost enough of her. She is as long, as genteel, and as dreary, as that deadly lively place, and sports, by way of ornament, her papa's hatchment, as it were, as every 10th Baker Street house has taught her. What induced such a jolly fellow as Frank Barry to marry Miss Angelica Coddicombe no one can tell. He met her, he says, at a ball at Hampton Court, where his regiment was quartered, and where, to this day, lives her and Lady Pash. She alludes perpetually in conversation to that celebrated lady, and if you look in the baronetage to the pedigree of the Pash family, you may see manuscript notes by Mrs. Frank Barry, relative to them and herself. Thus, when you see in print that Sir John Pash married Angelica, daughter of Graves Coddicombe Esquire, in a neat hand you find written, and sister of the late Sir George Coddicombe, of Baker Street, Portman Square. .bb. Follows, of course. It is a wonder how fond ladies are of writing in books, and signing their charming initials. Mrs. Barry's before-mentioned little gilt books are scored with pencil marks, or occasionally at the margin with a note of interjection, or the words O true, A, B, and so on. Much may be learned with regard to lovely woman by a look at the books she reads in, and I had gained no inconsiderable knowledge of Mrs. Barry by the 10 minutes spent in the drawing room, while she was at her toilet in the adjoining bedchamber. You have often heard me talk of George Fitz, says Barry, with an appealing look to Madam. Very often, answered his lady, in a tone which clearly meant great deal too much. Ray, sir, continued she, looking at my boots with all her might, are we to have your company at dinner? Of course you are, my dear. What else do you think he came for? You would not have the man go back to Paris to get his evening coat, would you? At least, my love, I hope you will go, and put on yours, and change those muddy boots. Lady Pash will be here in 5 minutes, and you know Dobus is as punctual as clockwork. Then turning to me with a sort of apology that was as consoling as a box on the ear, we have some friends at dinner, sir, who are rather particular persons, but I am sure when they hear that you only came on a sudden invitation, they will excuse your morning dress. Bah! What a smell of smoke! With this speech, Madam placed herself majestically on a sofa, put out her foot, called Fido, and relapsed into an icy silence. Frank had long since evacuated the premises, with a rueful look at his wife, but never daring to cast a glance at me. I saw the whole business at once. Here was this lion of a fellow tamed down by a she Van Amberg, and fetching and carrying at her orders a great deal more obediently than her little yowling black-muzzled darling of a Fido. I am not, however, to be tamed so easily, and was determined in this instance not to be in the least disconcerted, or to show the smallest sign of ill humor. So to renew the conversation, I began about Lady Pash. I heard you mention the name of Pash, I think, said one. Know a lady of that name, and a very ugly one it is too. It is most probably not the same person, answered Mrs. Barry, with a look which intimated that a fellow like me could never have had the honor to know so exalted a person. I mean old Lady Pash of Hampton Court. Fat woman fair, ain't she? And wears an amethyst in her forehead, has one eye, a blonde wig, and dresses in light green? Lady Pash, sir, is my aunt, answered Mrs. Barry, not altogether displeased, although she expected money from the old lady. But you know we love to hear our friends abused, when it can be safely done. Oh, indeed, she was a daughter of old Coddicombe's of Windsor, I remember, the undertaker. They called her husband Calipash, and her ladyship Pishpash. So you see, madam, that I know the whole family. Mr. Fitzsimons, exclaimed Mrs. Barry, rising, I am not accustomed to hear nicknames applied to myself and my family, and must beg you, when you honor us with your company, to spare our feelings as much as possible. Mr. Coddicombe had the confidence of his sovereign, Sir, and Sir John Pash was of Charles II. Apostrophe S creation. The one was my uncle, sir, the other my grandfather. My dear madam, I am extremely sorry, and most sincerely apologize for my inadvertence. But you owe me an apology too. My name is not Fitzsimons, but Fitzboodle.
What?
Of Boodle Hall, my husband's old friend, of Charles I's creation? My dear sir, I beg you a thousand pardons, and am delighted to welcome a person, of whom I have heard Frank say so much.
Frank.
To Barry, who soon entered in very glossy boots, and a white waistcoat.
Do you know, darling, I mistook Mr. Fitzboodle for Mr. Fitzsimons, that horrid Irish horse-stealing person, and I never, never, never can pardon myself for being so rude to him. The big eyes here assumed an expression that was intended to kill me outright with kindness. From being calm, still, reserved, Angelica suddenly became gay, smiling, confidential, and followed her. She told me as he had heard I was a sad creature, and that she intended to reform me, and that I must come and see Frank a great deal. Now, although Mr. Fitzsimons, for whom I was mistaken, is as low a fellow as ever came out of Dublin, and having been a captain in somebody's army, is now a blackleg and horse dealer by profession. Yet, if I had brought him home to Mrs. Fitzboodle to dinner, I should have liked far better that imaginary lady should have received him with decent civility, and not insulted the stranger within her husband's gates. And, although it was delightful to be received so cordially when the mistake was discovered, yet I found that all Barry's old acquaintances were by no means so warmly welcomed. For another old school chum presently made his appearance, who was treated in a very different manner. This was no other than poor Jack Butts, who is a sort of small artist and picture dealer by profession, and was a day boy at Slaughterhouse when we were there, and very serviceable in bringing in sausages, pots of pickles, and other articles of merchandise, which we could not otherwise procure. The poor fellow has been employed, seemingly, in the same office of fetcher and carrier ever since, and occupied that post for Mrs. Barry. It was, Mr. Butts, have you finished that drawing for Lady Pash's album? And Butts produced it, and, did you match the silk for me at DeLille's? And there was the silk, bought, no doubt, with the poor fellow's last 5 francs. And, did you go to the furniture man in the Rue Saint-Jacques, and bring the canary seed, and call about my shawl at that odious dawdling Madame Fitchett's? And have you brought the guitar strings? Butts hadn't brought the guitar strings, and thereupon Mrs. Barry's countenance assumed the same terrible expression which I had formerly remarked in it, and which made me tremble for Barry. My dear Angelica, though said he with some spirit, Jack Butts isn't a baggage wagon, nor a jack of all trades. You make him paint pictures for your women's albums, and look after your upholsterer. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.